All morning long, we've been hearing our colleagues at National Public Radio in Washington remember their colleague David Gilkey, who was killed in Afghanistan here over the weekend. An Afghan translator was also killed. You may not be aware, I just learned here within the past hour that David Gilkey spent 11 years at the Detroit Free Press prior to his stint at NPR. David Gilkey was 50 years of age. He joined the Free Press in 1996. And according to Daniel Bethencourt of the Free Press, over the next 11 years, David Gilkey's work brought him to witness the fall of apartheid in South Africa, as well as conflicts in Somalia, Rwanda, Darfur, and Kosovo. And Robert Hutchka, the Free Press executive editor, says David was one of the most intense journalists I've ever met, committed to telling human stories, even when it meant putting his own life in harm's way. David P. Gilkey, former Free Press photographer and video editor, dead at 50. It's Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thank you for joining us today. Republican Tom Leonard is serving his second term representing Michigan's 93rd District, covering Clinton County and much of Gratiot County. The DeWitt Township resident serves as chair of the House Insurance Committee and previously served as a Genesee County prosecutor. Last week, he voted to support a package of House bills to rescue the Detroit public schools. Those measures have generated heated debate in recent days. We welcome Tom Leonard back to Current State. Thank you for being here.
Mark, good morning, and thank you so much for having me. I think it's been almost 3 years.
Way too long. I've tried time and time again to get you in here, and we finally, the stars finally aligned.
I know, and I think my lovely bride's been here three or four times since the last time I was
That's
here,
right.
So I'm glad to be here.
That's right. We're glad to have you. I want to get your take on the DPS funding measure, which you endorsed with your vote last Thursday when it passed the House. The House measure does not include a Detroit Education Commission.
It does not.
Which supporters say would help restore much-needed order to school openings and closings in Detroit. How do you respond to people who say that's really important?
Well, first, I sat with Mayor Duggan on this issue. I know he was a big supporter of the DEC. And for me personally, I had two serious issues with this. First was I felt that it was going to get in the way of parental choice and would create an environment whereby charters would not be able to open, where they would be shut down. And I did express those concerns to him. But also, this thing, what would happen after a Mayor Duggan is gone? This man has done a great job for the city. If he runs for re-election, I believe by 2021, he will be out of office. I do fear what would happen when a Mayor Duggan's gone and this DEC is still in effect. So for me, this was about preserving parental choice and ensuring that, that would stay firm.
What would the inclusion of an education commission have been a deal breaker for you?
It would have been for me. Absolutely. This was something, again, and it was an issue that I studied long and hard. I looked at both sides of the issue. In fact, I actually had a dinner with Mayor Duggan. He came to my office for about 45 minutes on another date, looked at it. But again, at the end of the day, I had serious concerns about the way that this DEC would squeeze out parental choice in Detroit, and it certainly would have been a deal breaker for me.
Now, supporters of the commission also emphasize that without eliminating weak performing charters and weak public schools as well, it just keeps more ineffective schools in operation doing a poor job, and that it increases the chances of continued insolvency. Shouldn't somebody have the authority to stop schools that are not performing well?
Well, and I'm glad that you mentioned that, because we ensured that that was part of the reforms that we passed last week. As part of these reforms, there would be an A through F grading system, which would apply to both charters, and it would apply to the DPS public schools. And if schools were failing for three consecutive years, those schools could and would be shut down. And that would include both charters and the public schools. We applied it broadly across the board with the reforms that we put in place last week.
There are cynics out there who say that this bailout is destined to be followed by yet another bailout. Do you think that whatever measure Governor Snyder signs, assuming he signs a measure, that whatever measure is passed will help restore long-term stability to the district? Or do you fear those cynics might be right, that this bailout is just destined to be followed by another one?
No, I believe it will work, or else I wouldn't have voted for it. We have to understand this was
long-term, though.
Correct.
It will work long-term, you think?
I do believe it will work long-term. We have to understand this was 40, 50 years in the making. And many folks like to look at this situation. In fact, in my district, I have coffee hours once a month, and this is probably the number one hot topic issue that comes up because people want to know, why are we sending more money to Detroit, particularly Detroit public schools? And when we look at this issue, we have to see this. This is not a Detroit versus the rest of the state. We are all in this together. Constitutionally, we owe every child in this state a public a free public education. Moreover, they are part of the MPSERS teacher retirement system, which means if Detroit goes bankrupt and they go belly up, it's not going to be just DPS. It's going to affect all the schools in my district. Now, I explain this to my constituents. All of my schools are on the lowest end for the per pupil foundation allowance, about $7,300 per pupil. If DPS goes belly up, we very well could be on the hook for $3.5 billion in debt and liability. I looked at the numbers on that, and that comes out to anywhere between $1,100 and $2,200 per pupil throughout the state. That is a cut that my schools simply could not afford to take. So when we look at this, we have to understand we are in this all together. And again, I believe we put proper reforms in place to ensure that we are not going to be in this position years down the road. The main thing was making certain that DPS will be put under a financial review commission, much like we put the city under when we put the city through bankruptcy. They are going to have to demonstrate 10 consecutive balanced budgets before they can get from under that review or that financial review commission. If at any time in that 10 years they do not have a balanced budget, they go back and start to square one. So I do believe the proper reforms are put in place. I do believe this is going to work, but certainly we had to do something.
Our guest today on Current State, Republican State Representative Tom Leonard of DeWitt, representing Michigan's 93rd District. I know Mayor Duggan felt very strongly about this after the House measure passed. He was pretty upset. A lot of other people were, in part, I think, because you didn't have any representatives from Detroit support the measure. And Mayor Duggan says that whatever the governor signs should have support from Detroiters. How important is that?
Well, unfortunately, I do not believe the Detroit caucus and the House of Representatives. I can't speak for the Senate, but I can speak for in the House of Representatives. I do not believe they, in good faith, wanted to come to the table and solve this situation. Mm. They continued to move the goalpost, and as Speaker Cotter had mentioned on the floor, they had moved the goalpost so far, I don't even think Ford Field could contain how far it had moved. It seemed like every time we gave them what they wanted the EAA shut down. As part of this solution, the EAA is shut down. They were not happy with the original $30 million that we passed for startup costs a couple weeks ago. We increased that to $150 million to give them more for startup costs. They were not happy with that. I believe, in my heart of hearts, I believe there were some folks on the other side of the aisle that were playing politics with this, and they wanted to see it go into bankruptcy so that they could look at getting either more money or they would have an issue to play with in November. That's just wrong.
It is unquestionably a politically charged issue. Critics continually argue that this illustrates the unacceptable influence that charter school lobbies and supporters have in the legislature, underwritten invariably by the DeVos family. The DeVos family always comes up in this debate. This gets people really worked up. How do you respond to those critics?
You know, I think it's sad that we want to continue to pick on a family who have dedicated their lives to bettering this state. They have put a lot of time, a lot of effort to ensuring that there's parental choice in the city of Detroit. They have put a lot of time and a lot of effort to ensure that children can get out of a failing school system if they have to. So the fact that we demonize these folks is just wrong. These are people that care just as much about this state as anybody else. And again, these reforms, we put them into place to ensuring that parental choice would remain in the city of Detroit.
I do want to move on beyond the DPS here, but it is such a hot topic right now. Let me just ask you about where you think the House measure is going. What do you think the Senate will do to it, number one? And number two, What kind of measure do you think Governor Snyder will end up signing here? Will he need an education commission before he signs this, or do you fear he will not sign the House measure?
That is a very good question. I do not know what the Senate's going to do. Hopefully, they will take it up and get it passed this week. In regards to the governor, I do know that he supports a DEC, but I believe, and I may be wrong, but I believe publicly he has stated that it's not a deal breaker for him, that he could get over that and get this signed. You know, he understands how important it is to ensure that DPS does not go bankrupt.
He appears, judging, reading between the lines of his comments, it appears he seems to be saying, he would prefer an education commission, but a half a loaf is better than none. That's what I take from his comments. Do you take something similar or something different?
I take that he wants to ensure that DPS does not go bankrupt. That would be absolutely tragic. Again, if we are on the hook for the $3.5 billion in debt and liabilities, and that goes in front of a bankruptcy judge, that would affect every single school district in the state of Michigan. And that is something that we simply cannot have. Again, that would cost my schools anywhere from $1,100 to $2,200 per pupil. I believe that's exactly what the governor's looking at.
You referred to constituents of yours having the Detroit school issue top of mind as you travel around. Is that the issue you hear most from in Clinton and Gratiot counties?
It does. And when I have my coffee hours, it's probably the top issue that comes up within the first 5 or 10 minutes. And again, going back to what I had said previously, a lot of it is having to explain and educate why it is that we need to send this money to Detroit to ensure that they don't go bankrupt. There are so many folks in my district that are just tired of sending money to Detroit. But when you explain to them that we are all in this together, when you explain to them that legally we are on the hook for those pension liabilities, when you explain that constitutionally we have a duty to ensure that those kids are educated, they're fine with sending the money, but they want to ensure that there's protections in place to make certain that we're not in this position again 10, 15, 20 years down the road.
You worked in Genesee County for several years as one of the county prosecutors, grew up not too far north of Flint in Montrose, Michigan. As a former resident and public employee in Genesee County, I'm really curious to hear your thoughts on the water crisis, especially with regard to culpability and the government's response.
Yeah, absolutely tragic, a very sad situation, and something that we certainly need to make right. And when the legislature found out, we immediately, within days, we passed a $10.5 million supplemental to get the Flint residents hooked back onto the Detroit Water Authority. We subsequently passed, I believe, and it's been several months, but I believe it was a $50 or $60 million supplemental to ensure that we had National Guards troops on the ground, to ensure that we were purchasing water filters. In this current budget, I believe we're looking at $170 million for appropriations for Flint. So something we are certainly taking very seriously here in the legislature. And to Governor Snyder's credit, I believe he's the only person that has actually stepped up and took responsibility for this and said he was wrong. This was a colossal failure all the way from the local unit of government, all the way through and up to the federal level of government. We have to remember, it was the Flint City Council that voted to go away from a perfectly good water authority. They were the ones that made this decision. Then it was a financial manager that actually ratified the decision that the locals made. So at the end of the day, it was the locals that made this decision to leave a perfectly good water system and go to this water system that was bringing water out of the Flint River. And again, to his credit, the governor is the only person that I have seen has actually stood up and taken responsibility for this. I've got to give him credit for that.
Let's talk a little bit more politics. The presidential election—it's an extraordinary run-up to the presidential election here in November. Are you a Trump supporter, or are you a part of the anti-Trump community?
No, I will be supporting him. I will be voting for him. In the primary, he was not my guy. I was a strong John Kasich supporter. In fact, I was the statewide co-chair along with Arlen Meekoff for John Kasich's presidential campaign. Unfortunately, my guy came up a little bit short, and I will be supporting our party's nominee.
More Republicans who were, like not unlike yourself, who were originally hesitant to endorse Donald Trump or support him, are falling in line. Do you expect Republican anti-Trump sentiment to continue to go down, or could it continue to be a really important issue in the run-up to the election in November?
At the end of the day, I believe they will get in line. I believe they will support him because we cannot have another 4 years of the last eight that we've had with Barack Obama. And that's what we get with Hillary Clinton. I was watching a TV show yesterday. She could not even give a straight answer as to whether or not she believes there's a constitutional right to keep and bear arms. As you know, the Supreme Court is in complete flux right now. It's essentially four and four, and we have a huge election ahead that's going to shape the direction of this country for probably generations to come. That's why I can get behind Donald Trump. I know what I'm going to get with Hillary Clinton. It's not going to be good, and I would certainly much rather have the alternative.
One final question. Update us, please, on this measure you've been at work on for some time. This involves assistance for people with mental illness, House Bill 4674. What does it do?
This would bring much-needed reforms to Kevin's Law that was put into place probably about 10 years ago. The way I would describe Kevin's Law is essentially a home that was built without windows and doors. So the foundation is there, but unfortunately it's uninhabitable. It hasn't been useful because of the way it was put together. We want to make certain that there's earlier intervention for those that are suffering from mental health issues. Right now, we can't get to people soon enough. We can't get them the help that they need soon enough. And we need to ensure that we are getting them that help before they tragically go off and hurt themselves or hurt somebody else. So that's what we're working to do. I think we will get it done. It's currently sitting in the Health Policy Committee in the Senate, working with Senator Shirky on this, but hopefully something we will get done in the next several months.
Republican State Representative Tom Leonard of DeWitt Township. He represents Michigan's 93rd District. Many thanks for joining us today.
Mark, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
And coming up on Current State, the world is full of sounds, but how much do we listen to instead of just hear those sounds? A retired Michigan State University professor takes us into the woods to listen to what nature has to say. He's organizing an international conference at MSU this week on ecoacoustics. Current State's Kevin Lavery has a report coming up. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mark Bayshore. Book lovers treat their books in a number of different ways. Some handle them delicately and take care never to bend the pages, while others might mark them up with pen and highlighter to note their favorite passages. I'm one of the latter, by the way. People pick up my books and they say, "What did you do to this beautiful book?" Other people still turn them into works of art. And next Sunday, the Turner Dodge House is hosting Lansing's first book art show. It's called Boundless. It will showcase different works of art made out of books as well as handmade books. Here to tell us more about book art and the upcoming show, co-creator of Boundless, Zara Resch. Zara, welcome to Current State.
Well, thank you for having me here, Mark.
Are you an underliner and a highlighter, or do you treat your books with great reverence and never mark them?
Oh, no. I mark them every which way I can.
Some people pick up a couple of times. There have been occasions when people pick up a book on a table at our house when we're having people over, and they say, "This is criminal. You should never highlight or mark up a book like that." But I go back and I reread things, and I want to go back to the important points.
Oh,
you know,
books are beautiful.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you've got to share with us where this idea to have a book art show came from. Whose idea was this?
My friend Jane Ryder, the co-creator of Boundless, we love book art. And we've done this for a few years, but we have never seen anything on exhibit here locally. And we know that a lot of people that do this. So we said, well, why don't we bring all these people together by doing a show? And that's the reason. It's like to bring people who do book art together so that we can share ideas, share doodads that we put in our books, and, you know, and get to talking about book art and make it more visible for the local community.
Well, try to make it a little more visible for our listeners here. Give us a good example of a piece of book art that you've seen.
a book art is basically made out of a cover and pages. And you can make that out of anything you want, from junk mail, pieces of wood, envelopes, shopping bags, old books, or clay, if that's what that's your medium.
So, but you're taking a book, you're taking a physical book, and you're turning it into
you
something
can do that,
else. But you use other materials yes. as well, is what you're
yes,
saying.
Yes, and you embellish it as much as you want. You write or you carve it, you cut it, you paste it, you paint it, and make it your own.
Tell us about the bookmaking that you do.
I'm not as good as Jane. Jane is very good at making her book art, but I'm folding pages in old discarded books and then putting paper sculptures between the pages, like hand-cut butterflies or rolled paper or yarn, and embellishing my book that way.
How did you get into this?
Kicking and screaming. I'm a painter, and I basically use paint and canvas and just paint abstract art. I have friends that have been trying to talk me into doing this for years, and they would just insist that I do it. And like I said, kicking and screaming, I would just say no, 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 but they'll make me start with a page. And I started. And then when I did that, you get addicted to it. What you become is you become a collector. You become a collector of things for your pages. You become a collector of what other people say junk is treasures to you to put in your book.
That's the spark for you.
Yes,
is becoming a collector.
How
interesting.
Yes.
The other creator of Boundless, you referred to Jane Ryder. She's
yes.
also a bookmaker.
Yes.
Tell us about some of her creations.
Oh, Jane is a wonderful Zen tangler, which is making, she uses
Zen?
Zen tangle. She's a Zen tangler, which is making doodles with a pen on pieces of paper and creating patterns. And this is mostly is impromptu, it's not planned, and you just keep drawing more patterns and patterns. Everybody can do it. And she's very fine at it. And she's also a fiber artist. She knits, she crochets, but she doesn't knit or crochet. She does funky things. She doesn't knit a cute sweater. She'll create a sweater with ribbons and things dangling from a sweater. That's Jane. Mm. She thinks outside the box.
Now, this is the first, when Katie Cook, our
yeah.
producer, told me about this event and tried to explain it to me,
uh-huh.
this was the first that I had ever heard about this. How popular is this?
It is very popular, and I may be wrong, but it's very popular among women and artists, because women scrapbook and things like that. So this is an extension of scrapbooking, and I mean it's the gamut.
Okay, it's making a little more sense now.
Yes.
If you compare it to scrapbooking
now,
the eclectic nature
yes.
of a scrapbook.
Yeah.
It's kind of what you're doing with
yeah.
the book. So you haven't seen the submissions yet, because
no.
everyone will bring their works
on June
Sunday.
11.
Do you have any idea how many submissions
you're
going to get?
I know 15 people that said they will submit, and I've printed about 200 entry forms. So hopefully, if I get 25 to 30 people, I'm doing really good, but hopefully there'll be more.
But what you see when you attend this,
uh-huh.
does these works of art
uh-huh.
do not necessarily resemble books when we see them, or do
some
they?
Some of them may resemble books.
Okay.
Some of the books may have so many embellishments on it that you know, it has to stand up. It cannot lay down. Or it'll be on a pedestal, or it might be on a small easel. It depends what the artists do. It's like they're free to do whatever they want to the book that they made.
Is it possible for someone to look at one of these works and not see evidence of a book? Could it be so transformational that it's like, oh my gosh, there's a book in there somewhere?
No, there's always be a cover page, and there'll always be pages.
Okay.
But the pages might be an inch thick. So, you know, it depends how it's constructed.
Okay.
So I will be surprised as long as, you know, along with you, if you come on Sunday to see what these artists create.
I'm speaking with Zahra Resch, artist and co-creator of the book art show Boundless, which will take place next Sunday at the Turner Dodge House in Lansing. I understand there's something of a competition element to the show as well.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Yes. Well, it's a competition because to encourage people to enter, and the prizes are really good. So there'll be ribbons for first, second, third, and fourth place, and also a gift card for first, second, and third, and fourth place, and a mystery box of supplies for each of the winners.
Hmm. And is there an opportunity to purchase these as well?
Yes.
Okay.
The books, some of the books might be for sale, and if people are interested, they can talk to the artist. I encourage the artist to be there so the artist can talk to visitors to Turner Dodge House about their process, about the book, how they do it. And there'll also be a demonstration on how to make a simple book.
Okay.
And Jane will do that.
This is the first time a show like this has happened here in Lansing. Do
yes.
you think there will be more?
I hope so. I hope maybe Lansing Art Gallery would pick it up, and other people might do that. This is just a first time for me. So we're trying to do this. Hopefully the interest will spread and we'll have more shows.
Hmm. Well, I've been speaking with artist Zahra Resch, who is the co-creator of the book art show Boundless. This art show and sale will be at the Turner Dodge House this Sunday, June 12th, from noon to 5 p.m. Zahra, thank you for joining us
thank
today.
Thank you.
Coming up on Current State, he floated like a butterfly, he stung like a bee. Famed boxer Muhammad Ali passed away this weekend at the age of 74, leaving behind a legacy that reached well beyond the world of sports. Current sports host Al Martin will join us to talk about Ali's impact. That and more after the break on Current State. Connect with us here at Current State via email. We're always interested in your response to our segments, your thoughts, your ideas for segments, currentstate@wkar.org. You can follow us on Twitter as well, @KAR Current State. How many times has it been said there's a difference between hearing and listening? Sound is a virtually inescapable part of the world around us. Just as a doctor listens to a heartbeat to study a person's health, the sound of our physical environment can give some clues about its status. That is the science of ecoacoustics. An international conference starting today at Michigan State University focuses on this particular research. Current State's Kevin Lavery joins me now with more. Kevin, what does the environment sound like?
Well, Mark, I think we all hear it every day. Cars, birds, people talking, all these things and more. It's really what this mix of noises tells us about how healthy the planet is that fascinates researchers. So to learn more, I spoke with Dr. Stuart Gage. He is a professor emeritus from Michigan State University. We met bright and early around 6:30 in the morning a few days ago in a wooded area of Meridian Township where Dr. Gage has a series of sensors that record the world around us 24 hours a day.
I come here quite often in the morning to just enjoy the forest and walk the dog, and I've had four sensors here, so about once a month I come and change the batteries and listen to the sounds of the place. These four places are in the forest, but at the edge of the wetland. You can see over there, there's a young deer hopping away there. There's a big wetland right here next to the road, which you can hear the cars coming by here. Technophony.
Technophony is your word.
Right, technophony. It's the sound of things that humans make that make noise. So it's usually planes and boats and trucks and cars and jet skis and all those sort of things.
A mix of technology and cacophony.
Righto, righto.
We just got a visit up close from a bee, and we can hear the birds as well. So without looking at your sensors right now, just listening with the naked ear, if that's the word for it, what can you tell about our environment, given your training?
You can get all kinds of things. You can tell which species of birds are in the environment. You can tell when the dawn chorus is happening. You can tell when the dusk chorus is happening. You can tell about the arrival of birds in the springtime and the leaving of birds in the fall. You can measure ecological health. If you look at different metrics, measure biodiversity, or at least sound diversity in a set of recordings and so on. So you can do an awful lot with sound that you can't do with any other instrument that I could find.
We're talking with Michigan State University Professor Emeritus Stuart Gage, who is an ecoacoustician. Ecoacoustics is the study of the soundscape of the environment. And we're in the Ted Black Woods in Meridian Township, just off of Van Atta Road. Are we near a sensor that would tell us anything?
Well, we're relatively near a sensor. We'd have to go down into the at the edge of the interface between the wetland and the forest to look at one of the sensors. I have one in my backpack that I can show you, which is one I received from Australia. It's new to me, but it's fairly easy to operate.
Can you show me?
I will show you, sure.
This is a grayish-colored plastic box that looks like something that way back in the 20th century we used to call an index card holder.
Yeah, it does look a lot like an index card holder, and the nice thing about it, it's quite small and light. You can attach a microphone to it and turn it into an automated sound recorder. So if I open up the box, look inside, we'll see that it's wakened up, and it tells you I've got it programmed to record 48 times a day. So you can see on the screen it says next recording is going to be 7 o'clock in the morning.
That's about now.
So it'll start recording soon. And it has an SD card and a battery, and so it's pretty rugged and pretty reliable. So measuring 48 times a day, I'll get the whole gamut of sounds. Even though it's only a 1 minute long recording, you can certainly tell the difference between the time when the dawn chorus occurs and the time when the dusk chorus occurs, because there's a smaller dusk chorus that happens as well. And then we get into the middle of the day when most of the human activity happens. So I've got a fix on the time, which is fun for me to look at and analyze and so on. So I developed some metrics to be able to turn the sounds into numbers, and then each one of those values then can be plotted over this 48 times a day and averaged over a season, over a week, over a month, whatever.
I think we have company. That's an anthropogenic sound.
It is an anthropogenic sound, yes. They've the squeaking of the gate.
Do songbirds alter the pitch or tone of their calls based on the human environments? I mean, are there species that have been around for a long time, and when humans encroach, they either learn to adapt and call their mates a different way, or they leave the area because they don't want to be around humans?
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And some birds with higher pitch sounds get drowned out by the technophony and can't really survive or live in a place that is maybe nice, but too noisy for them to communicate with each other. Of course, that's why they have evolved to sing during the dawn chorus, because that's when people are asleep and the wind is low and the sounds travel the farthest. So some species can exist in very urban environments. It depends on the species. Some species are more sensitive to others. Usually it's the higher pitched ones are the ones with the most delicate sounds that leave. The ones with the louder sounds or lower pitched sounds can survive near human habitat. So hence we get English sparrows and starlings and so on at the near human dwellings, whereas we don't see many warblers and some of the smaller, more delicate birds nearby.
Are birds the only canaries in the coal mine, or do you listen to frogs, the occasional coyote? Are there other animals out there that indicate the health of the ecosystem?
Well, I listen to everything, and birds are just one of the dominant features of the soundscape, but certainly there are wolves and coyotes and even deer make occasional noises. They sort of bark like a dog when they get upset.
But you can tell, though, from study, that if the pitch or tone or something of these animals is off, there may be an ecological health problem out there.
Sure, sure. And that's partly, you know, what I'm trying to study is whether or not the environment is a system, or whether we humans have broken it up into sort of pieces that don't fit together anymore. We'll just head down into the pathway here and go into the woods. It's, I don't know if you'd call it old growth. I do. There are some trees in here that are a couple hundred years old at least. And it's mainly oak, maple, some beech, and cherry. And it's a pretty impressive forest, and they've built some nice pathways to walk along on Tuesday morning. And I'm going to bring a group of maybe 30 or 40 people from the Congress here to just walk in the woods and listen to the sounds as we just kind of quietly walk through. Many of them are going to be from Australia, some from Italy, some from Germany, some from Brazil, and so on. So I'm not sure if they've been to this neck of the woods before, into our Great Lakes state, and so I thought at least they could have a little jaunt into the Ted Black Forest.
Now, trees don't talk, but is there any acoustic signature at all with trees themselves?
Well, with trees, people have done some studies, and of course, the leaves of trees, when the wind blows, sound different depending on the species. But other than that, they provide the infrastructure for the landscape. They provide the resting spots for birds. This woods in particular, they leave all of the ground cover as it is. So if a tree falls over, and we'll walk along the pathway to see some of the fallen trees. But you can see from this wetland, which has dried out in the last couple of weeks, that there's lots of vegetation on the ground, there's lots of dead material and so on. And all of that is part of the ecosystem for housing and feeding the inhabitants.
So now that begs the question, Stuart. If a tree falls over in the woods and there's no one there to hear it.
Well, I might be there. I might be there. You know, since our acoustic monitoring is going on, we are more likely to hear the tree fall these days, at least in these woods, because I'm recording 24/7.
Is this the first Congress of its kind that you're hosting at MSU this week?
Actually, it's the second one. The first one was held 2 years ago in Paris, France, about this time of the year, and I wasn't able to make that meeting because I was in Anchorage, Alaska at the time doing another conference. So I got roped into hosting this one while I was away.
So these will be professional listeners who are used to listening to nature quite intensely.
Well, that's true. And we think that we don't listen to nature enough. Part of it is an educational program to encourage the younger generation to take some of their music out of their ears and listen to the sounds of nature. We know that the sounds of music are good, but the sounds of nature will bring them closer to places like Ted Black Woods and begin to appreciate the value of these places rather than chopping them down and planting trees in this area, which probably would have occurred if there hadn't been somebody like Ted Black to say, this is a special place, don't disturb it.
Dr. Stuart Gage is the coordinator and secretary general of the International Society for Ecoacoustics and the Ecoacoustics Congress, which is taking place this week at Michigan State University. We have been scouring the woods in Meridian Township, listening to nature and learning what it has to say to us. Dr. Gage, thanks so much for this opportunity this morning, and best of luck with this conference.
Okay, Kevin. Thank you very much for coming out and spending an hour with me.
From deep in the woods of Meridian Township, for Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
Hailing from Louisville, Kentucky, he was a polarizing figure in the world of sports, but Muhammad Ali's reach extended beyond your typical athlete. Not just a boxer, he used his extraordinary platform to spread pride, peace, and prosperity. Ali battled Parkinson's disease for 32 years. He passed away at the age of 74 on Friday night in Arizona after respiratory complications. Al Martin, host of WKAR's Current Sports, joins us here to talk a little bit about the greatest. Hi, Al.
How are you doing, Mark?
I am well. We're also joined by Current State Scott Pohl. We've heard of some number of Michigan people who have met Ali because he lived for so many years in Berrien Springs. Scott, you're one of them. Where and how did you meet Muhammad Ali?
Well, it was 1998, and I was sitting in O'Hare Airport in Chicago with my wife, Sherry. I remember the year clearly because Sherry was pregnant with our daughter, Morgan, and what happened led me to thinking about how Sherry, all the time, pregnant women, when they see a baby, it's like, oh, a baby, you know. We were sitting in an airport, I was reading something, and Sherry grabbed my knee and said, Scott, what? I just figured it was another baby. Well, this couple had approached the counter where we were sitting, and so they had their backs to me, and I was, what? I didn't see anything special about them. She goes, I think that's Muhammad Ali. And I saw that his hand was shaking, and I figured she was right. So people started sneaking around to get a better look, and I figured out it was him. And I approached the woman he was with. I confess, I don't recall if it was his wife or someone who was helping him. But I said, do you think it'd be okay to say hello? And she goes, of course.
Really? That was a response.
Wow. Oh, yeah. So we waited till he sat down. Everyone approached him. Huge line. The University of Illinois gymnastics team happened to be in the airport. The entire team ran through the terminal to get to Muhammad Ali. He posed for every picture. He signed every autograph, which took some time because he was shaky at that time. But I got to look him in the eye, call him champ to his face. And I had just the week before watched the documentary called When We Were Kings, which is about the fight in Africa with
right.
George Foreman.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so I got to tell him I had just seen that movie, how amazing it was, and what an honor it was to meet him. So a brief encounter and a lifetime of memories.
Yeah, no kidding.
That's too cool. That's too cool. Yeah. I can't top that, Mark.
And that's the show.
There are
the
better stories out there, but I like that one.
Thank you, Scott.
Sure.
That's really, really
Scott.
Interesting.
Wow.
What was your initial reaction after hearing the news of Ali's passing, Al?
Well, I think it was just sheer shock, just like everybody out there. I mean, I had gone to the Lansing Lugnuts game that Friday evening, and I was with my fraternity brother, and we had went across the street to the Nut House, and we're sitting there eating dinner, and I happened to just look up and peek up at the ESPN broadcast, Mark, and I saw 1942-2016 Muhammad Ali, and I'm sitting, I stopped what I was doing. I said, whoa, is that what I'm reading real? Is Muhammad Ali really, has he just passed away? And my frat brother, he stopped what he was doing. And there was just like this buzz that went around the entire restaurant. Just shock, sadness, and then, of course, reflection as the weekend went on. And you see all this candid footage of Ali back in the day and some of his most famous moments and famous fights. Just a sad moment, but one that you look back and say, what a career. What a career.
He had particular ties to Michigan that we alluded to here earlier. Remind our listeners how that came to be.
Very close ties to the state of Michigan, Mark. Actually, when you look at his ties to this state, after he retired, he lived in Berrien Springs, Michigan until the mid-2000s. He had an 85-acre estate along the St. Joseph River in Berrien Springs, lived there until the mid-2000s. He was involved in multiple charities, always doing things for kids in schools in the area there. And in 1999, him and his wife were a part of an effort to try and get more people to become foster parents as well. And there are countless stories locally here in the state about Ali's impact right here in Michigan. And later on Current Sports this afternoon, we'll be inviting Bob Every, who is the chairman of the Greater Lansing Sports Hall of Fame, a famous boxer in this state in his own right. And Bob had a very cool relationship, firsthand relationship with Muhammad Ali as well, which we'll be talking about later on this afternoon.
How do we see Ali's impact on today's athletes? Do we see it?
We certainly do, Mark. It's really inevitable when you look at just the landscape of sports today, just the fanfare. You know, and what amazes me about Muhammad Ali is that Ali, when we all know about the epic rants and the epic quotes that he used to have throughout his fight career. It's amazing to me because when you look at today's athlete, you see a lot of that within the sport of boxing. One of the most notable boxers that come to mind is Floyd Mayweather Jr. Floyd is always running his mouth, tooting his own horn. And that's exactly what Muhammad Ali, that's the kind of aura that he had with him during his fight career. But the thing about Ali is, what makes it so interesting is that Ali could talk smack and toot his own horn, but people loved him for it.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, when you see an athlete do that, you know, they kind of look at it as that villain, you know? So it's kind of a catch-22 when having that discussion, but you see that all the time. A lot of boxers, you know, talking trash and pumping themselves up. I think that the money in today's sports, you know, Ali was not just a boxer. He was a brand as well. And I really think that when you look at his career, he pubbed himself so much that he became his own brand. He flocked people to the televisions. I think you see that a lot in today's athlete as well.
It's interesting how he could be such an amusing, entertaining guy, and at the same time, he was at the heart of some of the 60s, especially 60s, most newsworthy. I mean, his conversion to Islam, his opposition to the Vietnam War. You were apt to encounter Muhammad Ali in the sports pages or in the news section. You know, you never
exactly
knew where he was going to show up.
He was more than just an athlete, as you just stated in the introduction, Mark. And I think that Ali was one of the first athletes to open that door of, from a perception standpoint, of the average Joe looking at athletes as just a guy who goes out there and dribbles a basketball, catches a pass, or throws a punch. Athletes have the ability now to use their platform for something greater than that. And I think you've seen a lot of athletes that have came after Ali do that very thing.
What's Ali's most memorable fight, in your opinion?
Oh, man. Well, I walked in, Mark, and you know what? Right now I'm wearing a Muhammad Ali t-shirt, right?
Right.
This is from the Ali and Sonny Liston #2 fight, where Ali knocks out Sonny and he's throwing his fist left and right and pumped up. I love that fight, but I have to go with, of course, the Rumble in the Jungle, as Scott just alluded to, you know, March of 1967, you know, to October 1970. I mean, that moment as well, because that stands out to me, is because that's when Ali left boxing. But for me, that fight between George Foreman, you know, the Rumble in the Jungle, stands out so much to me, October 30 of 1974, because he had just defeated, you know, Joe Frazier, and you see all this hype about George Foreman being this mammoth of a man who can knock out a man with just one blow. And that was the adoption of the rope-a-dope. I mean, how many times have we heard the rope-a-dope brought up in just everyday sports talk, no matter what the sport is, right? And just that fight had so much drama to it. It was so memorable because you thought Ali was going to lose the fight. I mean, he's getting pounded. He's on the ropes the entire way. And then, what, in the last few rounds, something happens, something clicks, and Ali ends up winning the fight via TKO. I mean, that fight is just unbelievable.
Hard to pick one, but that one certainly got an awful lot of notoriety. But the one immediately preceding it, fighting Joe Frazier, I want to say in the Philippines, there was an awful lot of anticipation
around that.
That's
the thrill in Manila.
The thrill in Manila, absolutely. What should the legacy of Muhammad Ali be?
You know, I thought about that question this morning, Mark, and I struggle with answering that question because of one thing. It's really hard to put a man like Muhammad Ali in one box. It's impossible because, again, he wasn't just an athlete. He was a man who transcended culture. He transcended society, and he made it cool and comfortable to stand up for what you believe in. I think when people look at the life and legacy of Muhammad Ali, I think that they will look at him as a humble man, as a man who dominated in the ring and in the realm of sports, but who also made sure to leave a footprint that extended well beyond just athletics.
More with Al Martin here this afternoon on Current Sports, 1 o'clock on WKAR AM 870. Bob Every will join Al with more on Muhammad Ali. And don't forget Current Sports TV Thursday night at 10:30 on WKAR TV. Al, thanks for joining us.
Hey, anytime, Mark. Thank you.
That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, opponents of diverting water out of the Great Lakes Basin are not hard to find. Tomorrow we'll hear from a Waukesha, Wisconsin official who defends the proposal. Plus, we'll find out why the greatest enemy to William Shakespeare is poison ivy as the company of Shakespeare in the Arb gets ready to perform at the Mathai Botanical Gardens and Nichols Arboretum. That and more Tuesday on Current State. Peter Worf is our executive director. Katie Cook directed the program today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, and Isaac Constance. Have a great day. It's Current State on WKAR.